With these, Doctor, it was a matter of willing. The young boy who masturbated was punished. There were all these cures for masturbation, which were all cures of control and discipline and punishment. They were hardly what you could call in Freud's a matter of sickness. But now abnormality is no longer merely, you know, having the boy sleep in another room, or having his nether part sleep in another room from his upper part, and having somebody watch him all night, which was one of the great medical cures, after all, suggested in France for a long time. It's no longer a matter of that. It's a matter of sickness. And that, I want to put to you, is a real revolution in education and in the looking at abnormality. Abnormality is not something that is your fault. It's not something for which the child has to be beaten, for which the child has to be disciplined. It's a matter of cure. Now notice, it's not accepted. Obviously, he was a doctor. It is a matter of cure. But still, in the cure, there is inherent an attack on bourgeois education, on bourgeois society, on the idea that is basic to entire bourgeois lifestyle, that basically everybody is normal. Sigmund Freud said, in effect, no, that is not true. That is not true. Your mind is a battleground. Not everybody is normal. You cannot assume it. Everybody's mind is a battleground. And it depends what wins. Your ego or your id. Who wins? What wins? Now that's a basic attack on the bourgeois lifestyle, in a sense, and certainly on the essence of its bourgeois education. But we must go one step further. Freud did say that in order to win the battle, there must be a greater cause. Now, that is a matter of degree and not absolute. But when on page 67 of your Dora discuss, remember that is the early Freud. Talk about the late Freud next time. But in the early Freud, he talks, we must learn to speak without indignation of what we call sexual perversion. You see, because you can't really blame the person. You can't really blame the person who is sexually perverted. I mean, from his point of view. You see, he's still buying the whole bourgeois ethic and bourgeois life. Die. Mikhail, indeed, who Freud would be sexual perversion and would be subject to a cure. The basic idea of sickness and cure of the doctor's dominance over sex is very much in here, that basic idea. Because remember, already before that, abnormality had been a matter of illness, and normality a matter of health. So that is implying Freud. Here Freud is a part of before the doctor taking over sexual control in the 19th century. We must learn to speak without indignation of what we call sexual perversion. Instances in which the sexual function has transgressed its limits in respect to the part of the body concerned or the object chosen. What limits? The limits of bourgeois manners and morals. That is what he means. We must not forget. We surely ought not to forget that the perversion which is the most repellent to us, the sensual love of a man for a man, was not only tolerated but encouraged by the Greeks. Therefore, he pleads, Freud pleads, that we must be tolerant, and only tolerant until he be, this person can be cured. Only tolerant until it can be sublimated. Now, therefore, you have in Freud always the limits of tolerance and the tolerance. So it isn't quite as easy as to say that Freud merely wanted an adjustment, that Freud was really merely making a bourgeois adjustment. It is a kind of dialect between sickness and health, tolerance and intolerance, in which, if you like, the bourgeois lifestyle is assumed. But the greater tolerance is pleaded for, both because it is a sickness and because it needs a cure. And that is because of perversion, Freud called perversion, would be regarded for a long time. But there is a third matter of Freud, which you can call revolutionary. coin Troy, there is no longer innocence. And that is revolution. For the bourgeois lifestyle does, if you remember Jenny Trier, include a kind of longing for innocence. A longing for innocence. And therefore, it was very important for something that grew up together with bourgeois Europe, the fact of childhood. Remember, childhood was a concept unknown in the 16th and 17th century, that it grew up only in the 18th century, together in a sense with the bourgeois lifestyle. And therefore, when you had children, you always had innocence before you. It was always your arcade. To be sure, eventually in mass politics, people looked to Arcadia elsewhere in the superior race, in the forests of Germany. And the more industrialized Europe became, the more people looked to Arcadia. But the immediate Arcadia for the bourgeois was not only the vacations that you also eloquently wrote about in your 6 weeks, and the woods and the meadows, but it was also the children. Children are part of people's Arcadia. Why? Because they are innocent. They represent innocence. And the great shock of Schopenhauer was that he said, no, children are little beasts because they are not civilized. You can only become human through education. Therefore, children are unhuman, which formed all German humor, including myself, when he put these children, when his disciples put forth these children, you know, who set cats alive, who collapsed the chairs on which old ladies sit and something, and sent me into a currency of laughter. Anyhow, it is a German humor, if you get out of it, the perversion of that. Children are not innocents, but children are malign. Schopenhauer, because their will is expressed without taming. Your will is only tamed in civilization. But for Freud, there are no innocent children, because sexuality starts at once. Now, that was a terrible shock, because Freud, in that sense, abolished innocence. That is it. It has had very little effect in the long run, because as I look around in all my medium long life, I think most of you still believe children are innocent. Most of you believe that. It's your Arcadia. That is why all this mishmash in our civilization about children. Because you think that's your Arcadia. That's your innocence. Whenever you look at a child, you think of the woods and the clear waters and the unspoiled environment. Yes. And I think of cats, tails alike. Depends how you're conditioned. But all of it, the thing I want to make, the point I want to make, is that that was the thing that struck contemporaries as most revolutionary. The sexuality of children. What that meant, really, was the abolishing of innocence. Freud robbed bourgeois life, any life, I think bourgeois life, because the concept of childhood grew up with the bourgeois, but it robbed our life of innocence. If you think of your little three-year-old, yeah, as already, with perhaps perverted sexual instinct, he ceases to be innocent, doesn't he? Anyhow, however that might be, these are the problems of the revolutionary problem. These are the problems of Freud and revolution. And these are the problems of how much Freud is linked to the revolt that we have discussed, and how much he is linked to making the tribal world more secure. And that you must not forget, because the Freudian, his disciple, there is very little doubt that his disciple, starting with Carl Gustav Jung and Adler, made the bourgeois world more secure. But there is no doubt, there is some doubt about Freud himself. That is why there is today all that great discussion, Russell Jacoby's book, Social Amnesia, and others, about going back to Freud, beyond the Freud. Because it is true that the difference between Jung and Freud, the difference between a kind of revolutionary impulse and no revolutionary impulse, whatever. So, you have a great difference, and the difference, of course, comes in a sense from the environment. You must not forget that Freud was very aware, for he lived at a time when he thought, two things were happening, quite rightly, in Vienna. Two things were happening. The irrational was triumphant, for Freud saw the first great modern anti-Semitic mass movement in Europe, to which we shall come back in another connection, about the mass movement which elected Luiga mayor of Vienna. And that first anti-Semitic mass movement in Vienna, that scared the hell out of him. And he believed irrationality was triumphing. And that is why he came as a Jew of the bourgeois in Vienna, seeing this first modern mass movement, really, in Central Europe, which was democratic, anti-Semitic, all of that. He came to be concerned with the control of the id. I think he came to be concerned with the id, which seemed to express itself, and he became very much, in a sense, under the influence of Gustav Le Bon. When Freud writes about mass movement, he simply copies Le Bon, as with Hitler and Mussolini and everybody else. The Bon's analysis would be the analysis which will determine these people's view of mass movement. So, you mustn't forget that. Second of all, he thought that liberalism was vanished. And like the tribals, he connected bourgeois life to liberalism, to this peculiar liberalism that you have in the tribe. He connected. And he thought rightly that the masses were coming up. Liberalism was vanished. And again, he was scared. And again, much of his theory comes out of this peculiar background. Now, we must say that for Freud, therefore, Vienna in the end of the century was a basic insecurity. And indeed, it was. It wasn't as secure as the Berlin of Wedekind. Vienna was very insecure. Its population tripled because of the immigration, largely of Jews, from Eastern Europe. And that scared Freud as well. He thought that that was the Greek anti-Semitism. Of course, after all, the population of Vienna tripled between 1870 and 1900. It tripled. And the result was an insecurity, which you have not only in Freud, but in all of that kind of Viennese culture. The other famous Jew of the time, Schnitzler, who wrote about sexual affairs, sex plays with sexual context, who was, after all, a very good friend of Freud. Schnitzler. And with Schnitzler, you have the same, a basic insecurity. Now, once you take all this into consideration, the insecurity of Vienna, the specific thing of what it meant to live in Vienna in Freud's time, discrimination, anti-Semitism, mass movement, liberalism going down, a basic insecurity in Vienna, much more than anywhere else. It stood out from the rest of East-Western Europe, even from Paris, by its relative insecurity and volatility because of this immigration. And these problems that went with it. The reaction against that was a reaction that should be silent. It's the same reaction that Marx had. It's a reaction typically of the Jewish bourgeoisie. It was a reaction of clinging to reason, of the exaltation of the 18th century dream. It's the same reaction that Marx had when it came to the insecurity of his time. You stress the 18th century. You cling to reason. You cling to liberalism. Well, some of you who are Jewish in this class would know that. Your parents that were liberals, I'm sure. You cling to liberalism. You cling to reason. And that Freud did. That was Marx did. And Einstein will do later. You cling to reason. So the final thing is that the reaction against the insecurity of Vienna is a Jewish reaction. And psychoanalysis is a Jewish sect. There was only one, two Christians connected with it at all. One was Jung, who split and who came to quite different results. And the other stayed and strove to write for its biography in its old age. But it was a Jewish sect. And it was a Jewish sect for a reason I think that is very germane. That the Jews thought themselves specially threatened in Vienna. The Luhrka movement was an anti-Semitic mass movement. It was the first time that Jews really faced what Marx said faced, as a matter of fact, in 1848, that democratic populist movements are anti-Semitic. They're always the enemies of Jews. 1848 on, they are anti-Semitic. And of course, as this was new, it created this kind of reaction. So that the landscape of Freud is proved or not. Freud insisted that his proof was in his case. All right. He thought he proved the landscape, the mental landscape. But the mental landscape is a landscape as a liberal Jew would see it in the Vienna of his time, and the liberal Jew still sees it today. That has not changed. Jews are determined by their emancipation. And the liberal Jew still see it. That is the struggle of reason and irrationality. The almost constitutional inability to come to terms with irrationality. Well, they're learning it in Israel as a different matter. Their irrationality has triumphed in these last years. But that's another matter altogether. Not talking before that was. To come to terms with irrationality. Very difficult. Indeed, almost impossible. And the result was that this kind of conflict in the mental landscape is a conflict that must have appealed to young, intelligent, educated Jews. Living in a society which was becoming a mass society, and in which indeed there was a direct connection that anybody intelligent could see between the mass society and the decline of liberalism, the mass society and the suspicion of Jews, even within the socialist movement. We will come back to that from another angle. So then, in a sense, life was seen as a struggle to preserve reason. But what did it mean in that context to preserve reason? That's clear. It meant to preserve bourgeois life. That is why the Jews are bourgeois, that excellent. It meant to preserve bourgeois life, to preserve control, to preserve liberalism. Quite rightly so. Quite rightly, it was a proper historical analysis, you want to put it that way, even in hindsight, as well as that is in a way irrelevant. What it meant, in fact, is the struggle between the ego and the id meant that the ego must triumph, that irrationality must be cured. And that cure meant an adjustment to bourgeois society. Lest you think that it's only Freud, let me mention something else here, which is, I think, of the greatest importance in this regard. The whole of modern intellectual history, and the history of art, is a Jewish invention, a German-Jewish invention. Why is the history of art a German-Jewish invention? Why are these Jewish inventions? Because from the Freud times on, intellectual Jews attempted to tame the irrational. Inasmuch as the whole modern history of art, for example, is concerned with myth and symbol, Jews, Freud on, became almost obsessively concerned with myth and symbol, with taming the irrational, with explaining it by taming it. And Kastira, all the famous people you can think of in the history of art, to a certain extent, in the history of philosophy, had a kind of obsession with it. And that obsession comes, I hope I have explained. Now, that means, of course, typically enough for Freud, that aesthetic sensibility is missing. This is true, because the aesthetic is too close to the irrational. And Freud had an almost textbook liberal upbringing. He was an almost textbook doctor, a textbook doctor, the kind of child every Jewish mother dreams of in America. A textbook doctor, clean cut, no irrationality here, good family man, wife on his open. All of that. But he went wrong. And he went wrong because he got the sensitivity to the atmosphere of Vienna, all of that which grew. Now we can see how Freud claims to reason very easily. Beleaguered rationality, which impinges on the powerful, is. Read you, not from what you're going to read, but it must be clear you're reading too, that, as you will hear, he says, we have been obliged to postulate the existence in the mind of a special and critical and prohibiting agency, which we call the superego. But why has he been obliged? That question is never really answered. Why has he been obliged to make a superego? That's an interesting question. In other words, it's easy to answer, because the ego didn't prove strong enough for sublimation. So there is the superego, which is actually nothing else but a prohibiting agent. The ego is other things, it's the agency of rationality, of harmony, but the superagent, prohibiting agency. So there has to be a prohibiting agency, all of this. And what then, as we might say, is the function of all this? Of the ego itself, in what I have said. We are in a position to attribute to the id characteristics other than being a conscious. Well, excuse me. Here it is. Fortunately for the id, which could not escape destruction, if in its blind effort for the satisfaction of its instinct, it disregarded the ego. In other words, if you had id without ego, it would be Schopenhauer. It would be Schopenhauer's blind will. That's what it would be. Schopenhauer's blind will. But there is the ego. And the ego, we're happy to say, the ego provides consciousness. And providing consciousness provides a link to the external world. So the ego is a harmonious power because it provides the link to the external world. Providing the link to the external world, Freud believed that it provided an agent of rationality. Because Freud believed, until the 30s, when it became ever more difficult to believe, that the external world was in fact a world of rationality. He believed that the bourgeois world was a world of rationality, even if it was a world of too many frustrations. Basically, it was a world of rationality, and that word belief would be stronger and stronger in Freud, the more the bourgeois world becomes irrational. The more the bourgeois world becomes irrational after 19, the more Freud will believe that basically it is a world of irrationality, or rather, let me put it this way, that it must be made a world of irrationality through sublimation. The more you sublimate, the more you must think of irrationality. So that finally, when the First World War was passed, when the Nazis come to power in Germany, but not yet in Austria, he likened the ego to the id, to a rider and a horse. In his outline, he said that, in fact, the id is a wild horse, and the ego is its rider. That is more absolute than the early Freud, because that leaves very little space for tolerance. That is a metaphor of domination, not a metaphor of tolerance. But that was his reaction to the fact that in fact, the bourgeois world is getting ever more irrational. That must, I think, be clear. And therefore you have the superego, therefore you have all of these kinds of things that I have talked about. This is how it puts the ego in the outline. Which he wrote, as I said, when the Nazis had come to power. The position is like a civil war between the ego and the id, from which can only be decided by the help of an ally from without. the analytical position and the weakened ego of the patient, basing themselves on the external world, combine against the enemy. In other words, in the end, even in Freud, the psychoanalyst becomes an ally of the ego against the id, an ally in what he now describes as a civil war. So the difference you can already see between the early Freud and the late Freud is the difference of tolerance, of limits. This is the Freud, deeply disillusioned, deeply troubled by the world. Say again, rightly so, right? So, with Jung, of course, that was never the case. With Jung, of course, nothing like that ever happened at all. With Jung, as you will see, the irrational is accepted. But why not? The son of a Swiss Protestant clergyman, insert, nothing ever happens to him. And we say in Germany, the dogs say goodnight to each other on the street. As much as everything has to close at 8, I think there's now one cafe that stays open all night. That's a great conception, I'm sure. So, what you have therefore is clear. Jung is much different. He accepts the irrational. He builds on the irrational. He is irrational. He supports the Nazi. He becomes the chief Nazi psychoanalyst. So, there's a great difference there. You know? There's a great difference there. And it is a difference that we shall talk about a little more. Now for Freud, there was always a necessity of repression. That must be clear to you. And I think it isn't too much to say that we see here the embattled Jewish bourgeoisie of Vienna. That in the end we see the embattled and losing bourgeoisie of Vienna and of Germany, clearly. The change in Freud after 1918 is much too great to ignore. It's in fact a very deep change, as you will see. Now, the actual way that Freud arrived at his result was through clinical study. But of course, nothing works in a vacuum. It's an absurd positivism to say that doctors work in a vacuum. That Freud was a positivist, remember. Freud based himself on reason, on positivism. He was from the bourgeois milieu. And his discoveries are so ambivalent in a sense, because they came through positivism. Because Freud believed that everything had a medical explanation. He didn't believe everything had a medical explanation. He would never have come to his discovery. That he despised the irrational. That he believed everything had a medical explanation. And that is how he came to it. Because remember, from 1882 to 1894, he slowly abandoned clinical neurology. He slowly abandons the psychology of Lombroso, the psychology I've talked about, the psychology which is positivist because physical, that man can be explained by his physical constitution. And through his clinical practice, he comes to see very reluctantly that it is true. And in all of his writings, there's a great reluctance. He doesn't want to shock anyone. He doesn't like the event. He's dragged screaming, as it were, into his discoveries, because his discoveries are, of course, against his liberalism, against rationalism, against all of this. So what would you say, you know, if a good doctor, if you were, you know, a good doctor came to you in those days and said suddenly that your little child had sexual urges? After all, he didn't like it. He had a happy bourgeois life, a happy marriage, and very unhappy children. But the children of great men are never happy. But that has very little to do with him, probably. But anyhow, you go then to the period which we call the Breuer period, his collaboration with a doctor called Breuer. And in this Breuer period in 1882 comes the first great breakthrough, the famous case of Bernhard Pappenheim, called Anna O, just O in psychological literature, who was cured because she simply talked, the famous talking cure. She talked out her childhood experience, and this cured her hysteria. So Freud believed that clinically he had something was true. And then in 1892, through the influence of Charcot in France, who had already pioneered here in this, he discovered that hypnosis was not the way to do it, but free association. And if he led somebody to freely associate, then suddenly, for some reason, he didn't know their hysteria would be cured, or their physical symptom of illness would be cured, their constant scratching or whatever, or even their sexual frigidity would be cured. If they could just freely associate, and he didn't know what to make of that either. He didn't know what to make of that either. Except that there must be some landscape in the mind. And 1897 is the year crucial, the year one of modern psychoanalysis. The year 1897, because he discovered myth. And that to him was a shattering discovery. Namely, that the stories the patients told were not true. That when they associated about their childhood, these stories were not true. Therefore, they had nothing to do with reason. They were myth. People lived by myth. And from the discovery of myth in 1897, an important discovery, that people live by myth, that their stories just aren't true, that what they tell you in association just never happened. That's reflected in the case of Dora. You see, what Dora tells him is just not true, that this are myths, and that these myths have to be interpreted, and that, in fact, these myths are a rejection of reality, that they have nothing to do with reality. A terrible discovery. For somebody who is a bourgeois, who lives in reality, yes? Who is a sort of from a tribal family, right? He has nothing to do with reality. And therefore, what matters about people is not their reality, but their mental landscape. And that, in fact, their mental landscape is tied to reality by a tender thread, the ego. And that, in fact, a cure is to strengthen this tender thread by which you are tied to reality. You have to strengthen the ego, and you have to strengthen the superego. In other words, you have to fight the id. And that is put now under sublimation. The more the id is sublimated, the more it is sublimated, the more the ego is strengthened, the more productive citizenship there will be. In other words, your action in the outside world, in which Freud believes, depends upon your capability of sublimation. That's a very bourgeois point of view. Jung would have quite a different point of view. How you can sublimate your id, this blind will, this Schopenhauer blind will. And the more you can sublimate, the more useful you will become, the more adjusted, the more happy. Because in the last resort, remember, Freud equated psychoanalysis with cure and therefore with happiness. He assumed, as every doctor assumes, that if you're cured, you're happy. He assumed that nobody likes to be sick. A wrong assumption, as we shall see later, because there would be quite a school of literature in art, and of course eventually that becomes perverted, because today everybody likes to be sick because there is the shrink. Well, for Freud there was nothing like it. He didn't think of all of you who want to be sick so that he can go to a psychoanalyst. That sort of fashionable affair wasn't there yet. So that's Freud believed that happiness happiness was in the last resort a trust. Happiness was winning this civil war. Happiness was strengthening the tie to the outside world, yes? But this happiness meant a greater tolerance and understanding than bourgeois society was willing to give. Sexual abnormality. So that what Freud really pleads for is, in my opinion, not so much tolerance, but really understanding. Because he himself, that is tolerance. Because everybody, the case of Dora, you will read, is partly a case about lesbianism, yes? But Freud himself thought that he had gone through homosexual experience. So that in a sense, sickness is for Freud a normal state of the brain, the usual state of the brain. But if that isn't fought by the ego and superego through adjustment, then you have to be cured. Be cured of the sickness. But we must realize that it is normal that every woman child at least has an Oedipus complex that is in love with her father. That everybody has had homosexual experiences, and after all, the Kinsey report proved much later. That must be understood, but not condoned, because it is part of the irrational package that must be fought by a reason. That is why, of course, the attempt to cure homosexuality and abnormality into life. Now, the most important book of Freud was, of course, his Interpretation of Dreams in 1900. But Freud was so unknown that the entire Interpretation of Dreams only sold 3,000 copies. So you can't say that this was a runaway bestseller. Freud was still pretty unknown. It was still a matter of a Jewish sect. And the Interpretation of Dreams was such a landmark because, first of all, proved it through cases. This is the scientific proof. It's through cases and through cures. In a sense, it's very pragmatist and positivist psychoanalysis. It proves through the cure. Freud always said, this is correct, but you're cured. So it proves through the cure. Secondly, dreams are myths, and they are the chief myths that you will see. Dora, because dreams are really your unconscious. Dreams really tell you of the state of the battle, yeah? Of the state of the battle of life. Because in dreams, your unconscious talks to you freely, and it tells you about the state of the battle. In dreams, you live entirely in your internal landscape, yes? And thirdly, the interpretation of myth is what psychoanalysis is all about. So, the interpretation of dreams is the interpretation of myths. You can put it this way, again, to end where I started in this regard, that what later on German Jewish art history will do to interpret the myths of Dürer or the symbols of a painting and all of this, which is a German Jewish invention, Freud does for the landscape of the mind. Well, later on, German Jewish literature like Auerbach's Nemesis and other famous works will do in literature or in art in the 1920s. That psychoanalysis does for the mind, namely the interpretation of myths. The center becomes an interpretation of myths. And the result is for Freud a very ambivalent one, is that the positivist becomes the inspiration for the fact that the main interpretation of the world is based on an irrationality, on myth, on a lie, and that if you want to get to reality, you have to interpret the myth, that reality is not enough, that reality is transparent, in a sense, and that you must get back to the mean. Now, that's pretty destructive for the bourgeois life, which is supposed to be based on reason and order and on the superficial, on what you can see, on all of the things of tribal. Jenny Tribal didn't believe in me, but Freud had to believe in me. And that is, I think, the key to Freud's ambivalence. And it is the key to the other fact that what we're dealing with is a Jewish sect, which was to become, of course, in the end, much more than that. But the court is that in a way.